This podcast is sponsored by Rask Invest, Owen's complete guide to money and investing. Rask Invest members receive Owen's official investment ideas, research on budgets, banking, super and insurance, plus how-to guides to get started. Visit the Rask Finance website to learn more and join today.
Hello and thanks for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast, a series exploring the investment philosophies and journeys of some of Australia's leading investors and financial thinkers. I'm Owen Raskovich, founder of the Rask Group. For show notes and other episodes in this series, as well as free educational resources, please visit www.raskfinance.com. Before we go on, it's important to remember the Australian Investors Podcast is provided for educational purposes only and should not be relied upon to make an investment, financial, or taxation decision. The information included in this podcast does not take into account your needs, goals, or objectives, and guests appearing on the show may have a financial interest in some of the products mentioned. Please read all the important disclosure documents and refer to the Rask Group's financial services guide on the Rask Finance website. My guest for this episode is Johnny Shapiro. Johnny is a senior reporter for the Australian Financial Review, Australia's number one finance newspaper. In recent years, Johnny and his colleagues at AFR have been responsible for reporting on the unravelling of some of our country's highest profile corporate collapses. In this episode, we talk about Johnny's career, growing up with a freedom fighter for a grandmother and a gold trading grandfather, and how his investigative journalism unravelled an ASX technology company's darkest secrets. Finally, Johnny concludes with a story of how he missed out on a 60,000 bagger investment return. But first, we start with the story. Johnny, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Owen. It's nice to be being asked questions rather than asking questions for a change.
Imagine. I'd like to start off this episode with a quick short story because I think it sets the scene really well for what we're about to discuss and put some context behind it. So there's a quote from one of the co-founders of Apple. What many of our listeners perhaps don't know is that there were three co-founders. There's Steve Wozniak, who was this technical brilliance, and then there was Steve Jobs, who obviously is the creative, the marketing genius, etc. But then there's a guy named Ronald Wayne, and he was the third guy in the trio and a largely unknown commodity.
Never heard of him.
Yeah, well, there you go. Never heard of him, right? So here's the crazy part. We all know Apple today. It sells iPhones. It's, you know, everything about it is, it seems to be wonderful and going really well. But it's been through some trying times since the 1970s. And in the early days, Ronald Wayne owned about 10% of Apple. Now, you could back that out and you could say it would potentially be worth billions of dollars today, if not maybe hundreds of millions, right? Now, he sold his stake, his 10% stake, for $800 12 days later. And on Facebook recently, he put on a post saying that it was character building. That was his quote, right? So he sold the stake, and he said at the time it's due to financial risks facing Apple, and there were some other concerns, and he was pursuing other ventures at the time. And I'll quote directly. He said, "If I had known it would make 300 people millionaires in only 4 years, I would have stayed those 4 years." Now, Ian Castle from the Micro Cap Club summed it up very well, and he said, "Wayne made the best decision he could given the information he had available at the time." Now, the key focus of this podcast is that information, how we get it, who provides it, and how you go about it. And that's why I'm thrilled to have you on the show, Johnny. It's a pleasure.
And it's a pleasure to be here. And I'm actually quite excited to talk about the role of journalism in markets and in finance. I think it's some people don't understand how it works, and I'd be happy to share as many insights as I can.
Yeah, great. I'm sure our listeners will really enjoy this episode. So some of the things we're going to do is we're going to talk about the difference between fact and fairy tales. But let's start where we normally start. And can you tell us about your time growing up, where you were living? Did you always want to be in finance?
Yeah, sure. So if the accent probably gives it away, but I'm born in South Africa. Mm. I guess I always consider myself a function of my grandparents. My grandparents on my mother's side were a anti-apartheid activist. They were pretty fierce and ferocious, and they made a lot of sacrifices. My grandmother was in jail for a long time.
Oh, wow.
It was and we're very proud of them to this day about what they – I mean, they were just freedom fighters, really, and they didn't have to be. So while a lot of people really didn't stand up to be counted, they sacrificed a lot, and it came to a cost for my mum and her sisters. They didn't have parents around as much as everybody else did. Mm-hmm. But I think like her legacy still kind of lingers on. We're always very proud of her. And then on my granddad's side, he was a stockbroker, a gold trader, and he just loved markets. He found a job in the Johannesburg Stock Exchange as a young man, and he just fell in love with stock markets. And he was a very interesting guy too. He was very sharp. I was considering him like one of the first high speed algorithmic traders, because I don't know exactly when it was. I mean, my dad's told me the story many times, and he told me too. I think it was the 50s or 60s, but what he did was he bought a telex machine and he hid it in the back of the office. So it was a big investment, but it allowed him to arbitrage the gold prices between London and New York. So the stockbroking firm where he'd started as a young guy became very powerful, because they almost made super profits for many years, because they had the secret, which was the telex machine, which allowed them to get the gold prices of gold stocks in London, which in a time lag would then flow through the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. So they kind of had an information jump, and they exploited it for a very long time. Eventually, I don't know how the secret got out, but by that time they'd really built the firm up into a very strong broking firm. So I guess when you join a socialist freedom fighter and a stockbroker at two ends of the family tree, you get a finance journalist. that's really my story. My dad was a stockbroker. Now he's a value investor. He still lives in South Africa. He runs global equities portfolios for clients. My uncle was a stockbroker. My other uncle was a futures trader. So markets are kind of in the blood.
Mm.
So
it seems to be. So that just naturally led to you studying finance at uni.
Yeah, I did finance at university. Got a job. I spent a year in Boston. Came to Australia because we had two uncles living here, and I wanted to spend time with my cousins and thought it'd be fun.
Yeah,
fun
why
thing
not?
To do. And then various jobs, and eventually I landed up at a company called Insto, which is interesting because it covers credit markets. And it was almost sacrilege, because we're a family of equity equity brokers and traders and investors, that I'd somehow found this job in it's effectively a trade magazine or a trade publication, but it focused on credit markets, which at the time, and I guess now still are, they're not as well covered as equities, because the punter isn't buying corporate debt, but they were buying equity. So it's not as mainstream, but it was very fascinating and interesting. And my job over the years was to update corporate bond investors, about deals that were coming and how they were doing and various themes. And it was really, really enjoyable. The most interesting part of it was around 2005-06, and the credit crisis, the subprime crisis was
brewing. Yeah.
And in Australia, it was really interesting because my very first job was I had to organize a conference on collateralized debt obligations, so CDOs. I had to find people that were interested in CDOs. And we had this kind of tip-off that the councils in New South Wales were being marketed CDOs, and it was hard going. And eventually I just had a list of councils, of finance directors at all the councils, like Willoughby and Gosford. And eventually I found like a whole crest of these councillors, these small councils that were investing in CDOs, and it was pretty fascinating. And scary, actually.
What was their motivation for doing so?
Well, this is fascinating, I thought, is a couple of interesting. I rang the Woollahra council guy, and he said, why would we invest in CDOs? Like, we can get 6% in the bank, and we buy a CDO, which is a strange product that I don't understand, and I get 7. So what's the point? Like, we've got $10 million in our bank account. Why would we go through all that trouble for an extra percent? It doesn't make sense. But what I found out subsequently is that there was an investment bank that was very skilled at advocating going above the finance director. So they would. One example I heard is they wrote a letter to the kind of the council and said, "Your finance director's incompetent. We've offered him a AAA product that pays 7%, and he's sitting there telling us to get lost because he reckons he's happy with 6%." Our AAA product is higher rated, better returning. It's simple mass. It's a no-brainer. You need to kind of sort this guy out.
Yep.
He's costing your council $600,000 a year of interest. And that's kind of how slowly but surely the council's loaded up with CDOs. And I wasn't that experienced, but I thought it was an accident waiting to happen. I didn't think it would happen in the way it did, but it was just a lot of hubris around then. So yeah, I'm really grateful for my time at Insto, because I kind of got to understand what the corporate debt market and credit just before it blew up. So
yeah, the good and the bad.
Yeah. So, but I must be honest, I was really naive when these guys were telling me about CDOs. I just thought they were super geniuses, like engineers. You know, and engineers are very precise when they build a bridge. Every millimeter, every measurement. I just thought that's what they were like with debt products, because they were obsessing over every little basis point. And I just thought they were just very precise bankers, structurers, investors. But that's all hogwash. I mean, I remember CBA were trying to do a deal at 14 basis points, not 15. And in the end, a month, 2 months after the crisis, they were doing it at 200 or 250. It was just fascinating to see the crisis. I'm kind of very grateful that I got that experience. And I guess it's probably like a lot of people my age that were in or around finance, the financial crisis has kind of still had like this profound lingering effect. Which is probably why I'm still very cynical on a lot
even
of things.
10 years later, right?
Yeah,
for sure. So this publication, was this going to sophisticated institutional investors?
Yes, yep. So, I think we had about 1,000 or 2,000 people that would pay $1,000 or pay $10,000 a year or something like that. And it was just an email. It was very simple. Yep. But it was really great because you knew the whole market. So I knew every fixed income investor. I knew every banker doing the deals. I knew every corporate treasurer or bank treasurer that was selling the deals. So I knew all the rating agencies. So it was really I guess that's kind of sometimes why trade press is really good, because you know your whole audience and you know exactly what they want, and you're providing them with really important information. So I really thrive. I thought it was just great. I was just a central node in this market, and I learned a hell of a lot.
Yeah, I can imagine. So what prompted you to go from that to the AFR?
Well, in 2008, I got offered a job at ANZ Bank because I knew all the bankers around the time, because I was covering debt, and 2008 is not a year you would want to spend in a bank, because Mark Smith was a CEO, and he was, I think he committed to reducing the workforce pretty dramatically, so I was a bit of a last in, first out. The trading floor was pretty interesting. I, as much as it was a brutal experience, it was a really rewarding one, because, again, I was even more closer to the action when the crisis came, and you could.
What were you doing?
I was on the syndicate desk, which is it's kind of a function where there's bond salespeople that are trying to convince institutions like AMP or Colonial to buy the bond, and then there's debt capital markets bankers that are trying to convince companies like Woolworths and Origin to sell bonds. So the one is the relationship with the corporate, and the other one is the relationship with the investor. And the syndicate sits in the middle, and their task is to manage the deal. Manage expectations. If Origin thinks they can raise $500 million, the syndicate desk has to liaise with the salesman and say, oh, there's only interest for this and at this price. So, and then when a bond deal comes, they manage it, and they manage the demand and the order books, and it was interesting, right? But there were no deals in 2008.
I was going to say, you're at the coalface of
that. Yeah, there wasn't very much to do except for lobby for your job, which some did better than me, clearly. So I was out the door at the end of 2008, which was a very harrowing experience, because at the end of 2008, I don't think people appreciate how much of an abyss a lot of people were staring into. I don't think some people thought they might never get jobs again. It really felt depression-like. All the things that happened afterwards were not foreseen, that China would stimulate, that the Fed would come to the rescue, that markets would pick up. People did not to your point about only knowing what's in front of you, the information in front of you at the end of 2008 was pretty bloody scary. And I was very lucky in that I got my old job back in Insto, but I just grabbed it a couple months later, and I was 2009 was a great year, because I've now been on the other side, so I knew my BS filter was a lot stronger than it was before I went into banking. And then, at the end of the year, I got approached by the AFR. I think they felt at the time that they didn't cover debt markets in as much detail as they wanted, and they felt that having someone with a bit of knowledge on credit and debt would kind of add to their coverage. And so their reason was the reason for hiring was the opposite reason why I went. I just thought, this is great. This is my opportunity to move beyond credit and corporate debt and kind of cover markets more generally. So, which over the years I've landed up doing. So I've been there 9 years, and I've gradually tried, just out of interest really, gravitate beyond corporate debt, which is still really, really interesting at times, especially when things get, hairy corporate debt. It's helped pays to have knowledge on corporate debt and credit markets. So I've just expanded out. I'm really interested in hedge funds, the macroeconomy, banks, markets, things like ETF. So yeah, I just fortunately the people guys at the paper don't constrain me too much. So I just look for what's ever interesting and centers around markets and investing.
Okay, so like you said, you've just gravitated to. Well, from what I can tell, at least, a lot of the stuff recently has been hedge funds, equity market facing.
Yeah.
So you've gravitated towards those big
pieces.
Yeah. Okay. So over the years, you and your colleagues at AFR have done an exquisite job of covering some of these big, I suppose, corporate, maybe we won't call them collapses, but there's been some things that have happened that would, there's some... I dare say the word dodgy operating tactics at some of these big corporates. There's poor governance, you name it.
Yeah.
And we'll dive into one specific example in a minute. But before we get to that, looking back now over the last, say, 5 or 10 years, what have been some of the highlights for you?
Oh, that's a good question. Now that you've asked me, I'm giving some thought. And some of the highlights are the lowlights as well. So I'm just one story that kind of really kind of changed me a lot was Slater and Gordon, which was a law firm that collapsed. And now when I look back and read the articles I wrote, I was like, I nailed that. I got that. But now I think I made a point to myself at the time to appreciate how difficult and stressful and tricky covering these things are. Like you don't know who's right and who's wrong or what and at the time, I was just like, you've got to just follow a process. Like, so when we file our stories at 6-7 o'clock at night, and then we go to sleep, and then you kind of goes into this quiet zone, and then the stories get out at 6 a.m. or they go up at midnight, but you start getting feedback and things around 6-7 o'clock in the morning. So it's kind of this quiet period, and you don't know if you've really screwed something up until the next morning. So often, if you've gone out on a limb to some degree, you'd be pretty anxious until that. And then the worst thing is getting a call, missed call on your mobile from someone representing the other side.
Yep.
But I think as long as you follow a process and as long as you know that whatever you've written is correct and to the best of your abilities or your endeavors, you've checked everything and you've put anything that you've going to say to the other side and you've just made sure that whatever you could have done to make sure the information is correct, you have done, then you shouldn't really lose sleep. So you should just kind of say, well, if it's wrong, it was because I wasn't, they didn't take the opportunity to clear it up or to the, again, exactly to the story that you told at the beginning, the information you have available at the time. So that was just a very interesting, tricky story that just both a highlight and a lowlight. I just remember, I made sure that I would remember how hard these stories are. It's the same for a lot of journalists. The hard stories are hard. Like the good stories are really, really hard because you've got to go the extra mile. I wouldn't say take risk isn't the right phrase because you shouldn't never take risk with information. But you've got to throw yourself at things and follow hunches. And so Slater and Gordon would probably, that was 2015, I think. So, and then this year was great. This year was really fascinating. The big un story was, it was again the same. It was that one I knew something was up from, like, there was no doubt in my mind that there was something that wasn't being presented to the market, and it was just a case of being dogged and determined. So there was no anxiety as to whether I was right or wrong, or whether I was wrong. It was anxiety as to whether I would be able to find out what exactly what was going on. Mm-hmm. I knew it was there. I just had to find it out. And I was anxious that I wouldn't be able to.
Yep. This is one of those, where I mentioned in the beginning, this is one of those fact from fairy tales.
That, yep.
Why don't we start with the fairy tale component of Biggin, yep. Big Unlimited. Why don't you tell us, let's put some context behind it. What did this company do, how it went about things, and then tell us why someone would have been attracted to this business in the first place.
Well, maybe I'll tell it in a way that how it came to my attention. So I think it was late last year. It was probably around this time, 2017, so November 2017. GetSwift was in the news because like the share price was going up and Fidelity were doing the capital raise.
Yeah, so like the best performer of 2017.
So I when GetSwift started going up, and we got started, I think Steve Johnson or Forager was on Twitter saying something's amiss here, and asking all sorts of questions about GetSwift, which was a really hot tech stock. And then they ended up announcing that they had some deal with Amazon, which again was just, it was very odd. Yeah. Odd's probably the word I'll use. And then they piled in later with a capital raising on the back of the share price appreciation. And it all just seemed like we needed to be covering it, is probably the euphemism I'll use. So I messaged a few people that follow that space closely and just look for companies that need a bit of work done on them, I guess. Mm. And that person mentioned Big, and I thought Big were a mining company. So I was like, this is really – and he said, well, you guys are promoting it. we're promoting it. And he pointed me towards the SMH had done an article, as a lot of organizations had done around November, because they Big had gone on a media blitz to say, oh, we've got this young entrepreneur. The share price has gone up crazy. He's really wealthy. Him and his dad have started this amazing tech company, and they've become very rich. So it's kind of a real rags to riches type story. But it just seemed a bit strange. I mean, what Big did was they made videos for small businesses. And what this guy that I contacted asking him for what he was looking at, the points that he made were the cash flows were incredible. Like, how are the cash flows growing so incredibly quickly? It just seemed off the charts. But you can't fake cash flows. So he's like, this is really, really interesting. There's something there. You can't be growing this quickly from making videos for small businesses. I mean, small businesses tend to be pretty cash strapped. Mm. And plus, no one's heard of them, and their platform's on YouTube. And then he said that the chief executive changed his name and changed it back. Like, that in of itself is not...
It's unusual.
It happens. It's not that it can't happen, but it's just one of those red flags, I guess. The other was that they were issuing shares like crazy at very deep discounts. So they weren't actually to pay their expenses. They were issuing shares that were at like 80 or 90% discounts to where the share price was traded. Again, which is all very curious, especially when they're generating so much cash.
Why would they need to do that, right?
So I tried to get to the bottom of it by the end of the year, and I failed to get even close to the bottom of it. So I wrote what I thought was a pretty balanced article. I sent some questions to the CFO. One of the questions was, why did they change auditors? They had PKF, which is a pretty reputable firm, and they changed to a smaller firm on the other end of the country in WA, So, which I thought was also a red flag. So I wrote what I thought was a pretty balanced article. I just said, this is the most unbelievable stock of 2017. And it's up to you if you want to take unbelievable to be positive or to be negative. and then I didn't think much of it until early the following year. I started to get people reaching out to me that worked there, and they were – something was wrong, but they didn't know what. I think they were just – I mean, I remember the one person just was in a bit of a limbo at the end of the year, feeling like a bit lost, and just felt the need to contact me. And I had got a tip off earlier that it might have had something to do. I had got a tip off that their cash flows, their positive cash flows, might have had something to do with Finstro, which is an accounting software firm, I guess, that they'd had a partnership with. and they were a subsidiary of a small business lender called FC Capital. Mm-hmm. So that was a very important clue. So I started to look into that a little bit more, but didn't go anywhere. Then this person sent me a sales manual, and you could see how important Finstro was in the selling of it all. And got a few other clues, but it just didn't go anywhere until I think it was around February. This proxy advisory firm and governance guys called Ownership Matters here in Melbourne, they did a report on it, and one of their clients sent it to me, and I was like, wow, these guys have also picked something up around and formalized it in a proper note that they've sent to clients, also raising issues around their governance. So I thought, well, it's a good opportunity for me to go to the company on that and to go to the company on this FC Capital Finstro. Yeah. And I just asked a simple question what the relationship was, and then I guess it all just unraveled from there. And it was a bit of waiting for them to respond, and then in that interim period while I was waiting for them to respond, we'd found out that the finance company was issued 3 million shares at an 80% discount. So that was kind of closed the loop, because you had a financing company lending them money to help their cash flows, but then receiving the benefit in the form of the shares going up because of the cash that they lent. So it was very clever, and that was kind of the first crack. But we wrote the story, and we got a lot of grief, because Big had a lot of and this was – I kind of expected this, because I experienced it with Slater and Gordon and a couple of others. But I think in this day and age, with social media kind of becoming more and more of a legitimate platform for people, or prolific platform for people to air their views, Big had a lot of shareholders that had done very well out of it and were believing in it. And I still don't know how they all got onto it, as in if it was promotion sites or – but they had a legion of shareholders that were sitting on massive gains, and the articles I was writing was not helping them. And I don't have an issue with them. I would probably react the same way, but they were just – I just got a tsunami of hate and questioning our writing and our facts and our – company put out responses that I didn't think were adequate. I think in hindsight, people would probably agree if they read them now. At the time, they thought that they'd beaten back all the suggestions we were making. So it got really tough, actually. It was like quite a lot of abuse. But that didn't actually – I think that was good, actually, because it made me – forced me to do more work and turn over more rocks. And previously, if I was less experienced, I would have figured, you know what, I've said my thing. It's up to regulators and shareholders to work it out. I've kind of led them. The information that I've managed to gather has given them enough clues to work it out for themselves. But the lesson in Big was that wasn't enough. The company could take the narrative back and discredit what we were writing. So fortunately, I started a few more leaks started to emerge, and evidence and things came my way. That I could piece together two very important, or I would call them smoking guns. One was I was aware of an invoice sent to a customer that hadn't actually agreed to the service. So after harassing this poor person all weekend to ring me back, and just a small business owner, they had no idea why a journalist was calling them and texting them all weekend, eventually rang me back, and I could confirm that there was an invoice, but the person had never agreed to the sale. So I thought that was very important. And then someone who's very good at accounts pointed out to me that I was bothering me all weekend. I was out for dinner, and I showed them Big's accounts. The last thing they want to do on a Saturday night dinner is look at financial statements. But they pointed out that the interest income is very low. I think you could earn that interest even at the RBA cash rate. They had $30 million of cash, but you could earn that in a matter of days, the interest that they showed. So they had $30 million of cash, but only a few thousand dollars of it. So that kind of led to the hunch that the cash wasn't really – they were showing the balance sheet wasn't really theirs. So did what's called a PPSR search, which is you search the company to see if anyone has claim over their assets. And I'd actually already done this, but I did it with the head company, Big On, not Big Review.
Yep.
Then on the Sunday, I was in the office because I was rostered in that day, and I was just fiddling around, and bang, I found that FC Capital had claim over all their assets, including the cash. So long story, like, oh, it's already a long story, but at the end of all of that, we could prove pretty definitively, and then they were subsequently forced to provide even more information to the ASX to kind of prove what we were hinting at, or even going further, suggesting that the finance company was just lending them the money against a sale that didn't occur. So those cash receipts were not actually tied to sales. They were just tied to leads, really. So for every lead, they were effectively showing $12,000 of revenues or cash revenues. And I think it became pretty obvious that, all was not how it was presented at the company. So, yeah, that was – and then it went into trading halt for many weeks and months. And, again, we got a lot of abuse. There were a lot of delusional shareholders that didn't think what we were writing was correct and that all would be returned to normal. And I mean, that was a pretty – I tried to understand – I did understand that a lot of people had lost a lot of money in this. So it was not a – it's not something to be – I mean, we're proud of our work and our investigations, but we're very mindful that a lot of people were in pretty bad positions after that. So, I mean, people that contacted me, I just tried to make that clear that, look, it's not our job to – it's just our job to find out what the truth is. And like I said, we're proud of that. But, I mean, we're not responsible. We're just the messenger, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. You're just the medium for it.
Yeah.
And this isn't just a little bit of money either, right? This was a company that was about to enter the ASX 300 or become owned by superannuation funds and index funds and these asset managers that would have billions of dollars to invest, not necessarily all in Biggin. But you mentioned there the idea that the company, this big review, which was owned by the ASX-listed Biggin, could, or supposedly, earned about $12,000 in cash from one video that a small business owner might pay them for. And there's a quote here that from one of your excellent articles covering it was where the small business owner might say, "Does this cost?" And then the response is, "Ha, ha, ha, only if you want it to." With our sponsor on board, the filming on the day is all covered.
Yep. So that's the sales script that we got hand of. So this is when people were calling up Charlie's Chickens or whatever, pitching them a video. This is what they were telling them. So obviously the business would say, "Sure, come on in. If I don't have to pay for this, if you want to make a video about my business, go for your life." So, but they were able effectively to book that as a sale, and the finance company would advance the $12,000. It'd all get siphoned off into trust accounts so that couldn't all be blown up or spent. But, yeah, they were basically – the businesses were agreeing because it was free. And that, to my understanding, that's what Big were focused on doing, was just they had these salespeople trying to just – give away free videos.
Just get an invoice with an ABN number or something.
Yeah, yeah. So that was our thesis, which I think's proved to be the case now. So
the association with Finstro is an interesting one because – and this runs deep through our financial system because there was directors on this company's board and who were quite, I suppose you could say, prolific. They were quite ingrained in the Australian financial system. So there were many bad actors and people that perhaps – turn the head to some of the facts that were going on.
Well, that's I mean, that's a tricky question because there are very senior people that were associated with that, but we don't know what they knew and what they didn't know. Some of the points I tried to make in the coverage was that sometimes you just hope people in these positions of authority do kind of stand up and be counted for and say something or act or put an end to something rather than just try and say that they had nothing to do with it or no knowledge of it, because they are, I mean, in this case, the person was financially, as best as I can understand, if you follow the ownerships, this person would have been benefiting from that. So, and again, I wouldn't suggest in any way there was any wrongdoing, but sometimes I guess you hope that people stand up and be counted for. I mean, Australian financial system relies on governance, on people in boards, directors to take stand to govern, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
and there's governing in a formal sense and there's governing in an informal sense. There's vote, like performing your duties, you know, official duties. But I think there's also sometimes, maybe, my hope or belief is that people use their positions of authority and, to kind of make sure these things don't happen or get as far as they do, or when they do, try to prevent the next one. So I will get off my high horse now.
Okay.
Before I get into trouble.
So why don't we think a bit about what happened after the fact. So this company's gone into suspension. Bring it up to today. It's as the subsidiary now filed for voluntary administration?
It filed for voluntary – the subsidiary and the main company filed for voluntary administration. The subsidiary was restructured through a deed of company arrangement. So effectively the creditors took control of it. But my understanding as of right now, what's happening at the moment is that that's collapsing and it's going to – now these – both entities are potentially going to be unwound. So – but it's delisted. It's not – doesn't trade. It stopped trading a few months ago.
It seems like everyone's lost out of this deal, right? Like the shareholders have obviously lost money. But there's also the people that worked, I suppose, that maybe perhaps didn't understand further down the chain, the call centres and things, didn't understand perhaps what they were getting themselves into. And now we see that it's down to 2 days a week of work, might not be paid super and all those types of things. So this is all around, this is just a blemish, I suppose.
Well, I think that's beyond big. That's an important point of consideration for companies that are, being exposed or targeted, rightly or wrongly, is that there are staff that work there and livelihoods and careers. So, I mean, I try to be mindful of that as much as I can without losing focus on what my role is. But, yeah, there are can't ignore that there's huge personal costs in success and failure. So,
and this we should say that this isn't a one-off thing, right? That unfortunately, we do see it around the place, and it rears its ugly head every now and again. Some of the more recent examples might be, say, Blue Sky. It's about the same time. You mentioned Slater and Gordon, and even. More recently, this is a very present thing, but corporate travel is now a focus of some short sellers as well.
Yeah.
I'm interested to know, in your opinion, do you think that an ordinary investor, a mum and dad, can detect these types of poor governance, these instances of poor governance?
No. And nor can a lot of institutional investors in my experience. They're not easy to detect. It's difficult. From my credit reporting on credit days, a lot of credit investors would be sideswiped by things out of the blue, and they would acknowledge that they just cannot. You just cannot see these things coming. Some people are very good at finding them out, but that's a very different skill set. I think for mum and dads, it's very hard. I mean, that they. If there's any kind of overriding lesson, but based on the way I invest, which is not very well, I would not be one to give investing advice. But I guess if you understand the business and the company and you're comfortable, and this was a key lesson in big, and I'm amazed that not many people know, like, act in this way. But diversification, I mean, that is – people would – and there were very sad stories about how much people had lost in big, and they put all their money into it and other stocks, but – you should never put a meaningful portion of your money into any stock, speculative or not. I mean, even some safe stocks like AMP are they down 50%? Well, not safe, but perceive to be blue chips.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't give investing advice. I don't think that's investing advice. No, I think that's not. Just common sense. But and that was the reaction I got. I wrote a story about big and all the investors that were in a very dark place once it emerged that big was probably – going to zero, and I wrote an article, and a few investors helped me with that and reached out to other investors, and it was all not quoted. I didn't name any of the investors, but the reaction I got from a lot of people was, well, the first reaction was, this is really sad, and I wanted to kind of raise awareness as to the cost of these things, but a lot of people shot back, which I don't disagree with, that what were they thinking? Why did they have so much money in such a speculative stock? No matter how good the idea is, like, you just can't do that. You just should not do that. It's madness. It's risky. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, this time it's different, right? That's what everyone thinks.
Yeah. Yeah. And by all means, I hope I'm not sounding like I'm giving investing advice. By all means, feel free. Like, it wouldn't hurt to make a bet that's got a high payoff. That's a good way to invest. Mm. But just don't bet everything on those kinds of things.
I think that's a good bit of information there. But we talked about Slater and Gordon. That made a big acquisition in the UK that turned out to be a bit foul. One thing that you've penned recently was this discussion around roll-ups.
Yep.
And I think I've got the quote here. It's roll up for the next blow-up.
Yeah. That was my colleague Jemima that came up with that headline.
That's great. Right. Can you explain the mechanics behind a roll-up, maybe even just what it is, and then
they're very interesting, actually. They are very interesting beasts that are pretty prevalent in Australia and around the world. I guess that in America they call them platform companies, and they're very interesting because I think, to my mind, they're taking advantage of the way stock markets price a company versus the way a private market, or I guess a private business investor would price a company. And they use that to arbitrage. So if a company is on 10 times earnings and it buys a company on 5 times earnings, it takes the earnings and rolls it up into – and then those 5 times earnings get re-rated at 10 times earnings. And
so it looks like it's making more profit.
All things being equal, the value of the company goes up purely from buying a business with a lower multiple. Hmm. But if that really did create value, then any company, even if they were, a nuts and bolts maker would buy a clothing manufacturer if they were on a lower multiple. So, like, the logic, at its extreme, the logic doesn't work, but the stock market seems to reward those kinds of deals, and maybe more so now. This is just a theory, but maybe when there's more kind of quant money and they're looking at earnings growth and analysts getting forecasts and acquisition increases the earnings, it might marginally drive more money into that stock. Although that it has roll-ups have been sucking in investors for years, and there are actually some roll-ups are not. Not all roll-ups are bad as well. If your strategy is to buy businesses that you think you can add value operationally or through scale, or there's one in Canada called Constellation Software, which has been a huge success. And
Mark Leonard.
Yeah, and if you take him at face value, which it's hard not to after he's been so successful for so long, is that he just believes that he can identify good software companies and go in and just organizationally add value to that business and then to his business. So,
yeah, I think that's a great example. Constellation can do so. Mm. And I think one of the important points about that is Constellation very rarely issues new shares.
Yes, good
so
point. Yeah.
It uses its free cash flow, so to speak,
yes,
to fund these acquisitions and pay off over time, rather than, say, some of the mechanics and the magic, if you like, behind issuing shares and then arbitraging that.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And when I wrote that article, I rang quite a few people that I respect that are very insightful. And I said, well, what is a rule of thumb for knowing a good roll-up and a bad roll-up? And they said, well, it's not an absolute rule of thumb, but a good guide is if – company doesn't issue new stock, but I'm sure there's probably multiple examples.
Exception to that,
without doubt.
Yeah.
So
this is a good segue into one of the more recent topics and one of the companies that you've covered recently, which is corporate travel management.
Yes.
This is a travel business that, as it says on the tin, provides travel solutions to corporate clients. Can you explain the genesis of the story and where we're at now?
It's a very interesting one, and to me it shows the sophistication of short sellers and companies. Mm. So the increased sophistication of short sellers and companies that are subject of a short seller rate. I think both sides have kind of scaled up and become more sophisticated. So this one came, I think, end of October. VGR, which is a hedge fund that's got pretty good reputation for finding shorts, came out with a detailed report, it's 176 pages, looking at the accounts, looking at red flags that they found in the accounts, claims that they had patented technologies. They did a whole global search and found there were no patents at all linked to corporate travel. Then they don't know how exactly they did this, but they ran around the world and they managed to get photos of all their offices and showed that either some of the locations were not there or they were not manned. They were
phantom offices.
Phantom and ghost offices. And it was a pretty, at its surface, pretty devastating report.
Mm.
But the company went to halt for 2 days. So VGR put out the report on the Sunday, so they didn't put it out during market hours. Mm. So that allowed the company, I don't know if this was the intention, but it allowed the company to not trade on, to go into trading halt, and they had 2 days to respond.
Mm.
Then they responded and they felt that they refuted the claims. The stock went down, I think, 20%, 25%. Mm. Then VGR put out another report. If I could summarize, it was basically saying that they didn't answer the questions and some of their responses raised more questions. Mm. Corporate travel then hit back again, and their final response to date was contained some qualifying statements from Ernst & Young, suggesting that Ernst & Young had looked at the accounts, aspects of the accounts, and given it a tick. So that was, it's fair to say, welcomed by a lot of investors, and I think the stock's run up a little bit. I think net it's down maybe 15% or something like that at the moment. But it's very interesting. So both sides are and it's interesting to contrast it to Blue Sky, which was the subject of also of a short report by a very different outfit. So Glaukos, which is a US-based research firm, to the best of my knowledge, they're not like a registered fund manager with investors. They specialize in writing reports and taking positions on the back of that. So Glaukos wrote a report on Blue Sky, and that came during market hours, so they had to halt the stock. And I think it's a consensus view that Blue Sky did not respond well at all to that.
They just
that.
Denied everything. Is it?
They denied everything. They got very emotive. They called all their ASX statements response to foreign shorts. Foreign shorter opinion piece, I think, is what they used. And I just don't think that sat well with a lot of investors that were sitting on the fence or cynical. I just don't fit that. I think the key moment for Blue Sky was when they had an earnings call and everyone kind of rubbed their hands together and go, great, the CEO or the managing director is going to front investors, is going to take questions. So no matter how curly they are, he's obviously prepared, because – he's prepared for anything. He's prepared to go on a call and take questions, because they'd scheduled the call the following day. And everyone thought that was a very positive move. And then the call ended and he just said, thank you for dialing in. So all he did was read a prepared statement, which they could have posted on the ASX. Yeah. There was no need for a call to do that. And I think when the phone hanged up, I think that was, you could almost hear a gasp across the whole country. So there were a few things, and I guess all of that is aside from who's right or wrong or whatever. It's just how they handle the situation. So I think it's too early to say anything on corporate travel, and it's not really my role to. Our role is to see how this plays out and cover it and gather as much information as we can. So where corporate travel goes, who knows at the moment. But I think just if you're just focusing on how Blue Sky and corporate travel responded to these reports, it's clear that the targets have become more sophisticated in their defence.
There's been some early learnings from some of these targets. One of the things that struck me about this VGI report on corporate travel was that, I suppose from my position as an advisor, I try to look for fairness in the system and how the market can keep its integrity.
Yeah.
And one of those things is that everyone's equally informed, right? But given that many investors won't have access to these short reports simply because the companies are not authorized to distribute them, etc., I wonder if there is a better mechanism for these ideas to come to market.
Yes. It's interesting, and what I would say is I think all three sides in this debate, debate's probably a euphemism to describe this, would want that. So I don't think there's anybody out there that doesn't want all the information to be as widespread as possible. At least that's what they say. So I think VGR would probably want their report to be read by as many people as possible, all 176 pages and all 8 pages in their response. Corporate Travel may want the same in terms of they would be happy for that. I don't know that, but that they I think there was general agreement when I wrote a piece about this that yes, that it is not good to have information
that is material.
Material accessed by some and not by others. I think the regulator would also like that. The kind of the spanner in the works is that corporates are not allowed to publish research reports.
Right.
So if Morgan Stanley puts a buy on XYZ and writes a whole long, I mean, they're not allowed to put that on the ASX, which I think there's logic to that because they could be very selective in the research they put up. So ASX just says no, or you can't put up broker research. So this would probably constitute some kind of research. And a lot of small companies commission research in the hope that it will be, or in the strong likelihood that it will turn out to be positive. So I guess if they can put that on the ASX, it could be a free-for-all.
And
someone explained to me that the ASX's view of the ASX is that an analyst or a broker wouldn't and shouldn't have any better ability to predict earnings than the company itself. So there isn't really much real value in at least in theory, as to what a broker does, because they're using the same information provided by the company, and if the company could accurately forecast anything or make predictions, it should come from the company. I think that's kind of a bastardized summary of how it was explained to me. So
yeah, well, it's not perfect, right? That's the problem.
But there's no doubt that broker earnings revisions and notes are probably moving the market now more than they ever have, ironically. So it absolutely is market-moving information.
Particularly with some of these big stories recently, particularly some that you and your team have broken, it certainly seems that the short reports are, at least from these reputable houses, really moving the dial. I mean, we talked about Corporate Travel. That, if it drops 15 or 20%, that's a pretty effective trade for some short sellers.
Yep.
So it's just one of those things, I suppose, that we have to deal with if we're retail investors or small investors. Not perfect, but
And I know you brought this up when you spoke to Ben McGarry. I mean, I think he argued, as would I, that the more information, the better. And I think he cited the example of Credit Corp. So the market will chew up and spit out research that's rubbish, you'd like to think. So any information, good or bad, is helpful. But I guess in this case, it's this difficult situation where, or this unusual situation where the information is having a big impact, but it's not being disseminated equally. So,
yes, indeed. Okay, well, as we come to the end of our chat, I wanted to pick your brain on where you see finance journalism going over the next decade.
Hopefully onwards and upwards. I think it's in a, I can't speak for the paper, I think it's in a healthier place than it has been for a while. Just newspapers generally, I think, have gone through the hard times. I think papers in general and mainstream media is, it's not the only show in town, but it's got a more targeted, important purpose now, I think. So there's plenty of voices, which I welcome. I think it's really good. But I think mainstream media's got, One thing I find a newsroom and a finance newsroom has got is lots of resources. So we've got legal counsels that can help us make sure whatever we write isn't going to get us in trouble. And they're like the unsung heroes of the newsroom and of, I think, of democracy, because they are your check to get really important information out there. We've got access to information. We got access to executives, to fund managers. So we really sit in an unbiased, important node. So I feel like finance journalists at mainstream media organizations have got a very, very important role. And Corporate Travel is probably a good example. I think it's very hard for someone outside of a mainstream organization to cover that, to have the access to cover that well. look, whether we cover it well or we mess it up or we don't get everything right, or we always get our fact right. But it's harder for somebody just to sit at home on their computer and because they don't have the ability to. It's not a skill thing; it's just a situation.
Yeah, you've got the network
resources to be able to get to the bottom of things and to provide valuable information. So I think newsrooms. It's funny, as there's more information. corporate travel is a great example. So there's never been more information. You keep hearing out, there's almost an overload of information. Mm. Yet you still see these highly divisive situations where there's people don't know the greater truth. But despite all the information out there, corporate travel, I think you've got a pretty split camp, don't you? You've got two people arguing vociferously their cases. And all the information, as much information is out there, and it's still undecided. So even though there's more information, I think there's still a role. And I think it will become more and more important. Finance journalism. I think situations like this are probably where we add a lot of value, and it looks like they're becoming more frequent. I think it's bright. it's going to be labor intensive.
Yeah, one of the things that I suppose not. In a way, it concerns me. And from an investment point of view, purely, I encourage people to hear the opposite side of the debate, right?
Yep.
So to get that, I think this stock's going up. Who thinks it's going down?
Yep.
That's probably more valuable than the person that agrees with you, right?
Absolutely.
And I think with social media and the role that it plays now, our circles of where we get our information are growing tighter and tighter. We just find the people that agree with us typically.
Yeah.
And we follow them or we like what they do. So we just follow, that's where we get our source of information. That's our source of information. And that's probably a trend that does concern me a bit.
Yeah.
Whereas we still need these big stalwarts of information, these guys like yourself and your team that go out and are willing to put in the work to get the facts straight.
I think so. I mean, there's people that will argue with us on social media, the same people arguing the opposite. They give all sorts of criticisms for mainstream media.
Mm.
There might be some tinges of truth in some of them, but generally I think we're pretty important institutions, and I think overall we add a lot of value to society, to financial markets, to corporate Australia. I really strongly believe that we do. So I mean, one of the things is always, oh, you only write negative. I was just checking my Twitter today and there was somebody saying, AFR or finance, negative news sells. But I think that's just the wrong way of looking at it. I mean, firstly, that's nonsense. What correlation is there between negative news and selling newspapers? But, I mean, there's like an adage in the newsroom, and again, I might get the exact wording of it wrong, but like the news is the stuff that people don't want to be out there. So positive stories, they find their way.
Mm.
Like it's the negative. It tends to be the negative news or the that people don't want out there. So if we're obviously going, if we're writing important stuff, it doesn't have to be negative. But in my experience, it's very seldom that someone has a great news story that they're hiding from you or they've been socked away for you to discover. They do happen. Like there are very modest people that have done something amazing and they don't want you to know about it, or they just want to stay under the radar or things like that. And you uncover them, and they're great when you do that. But that still fits the kind of the mold of something that a person or something that nobody wants you to write. So that's why people would think that we only write negative news, but that's not true. And we write plenty of positive stuff.
Mm.
I mean, we have the Rich List, which is a celebration of achievement. So again, I don't want to be a spokesman for the paper, more a spokesman against some of the criticisms that come our way. I think the stuff that people don't want you to know is where we add a lot of value. But it's not only what we write.
That's where it becomes, I suppose, add to that efficiency.
Yeah.
Okay, so you mentioned Twitter. Where else could people, I suppose, hear more about you and the team? What's the best place? Just go to the website?
Subscribe to the AFR.
Yeah, subscribe to the AFR. Great. Yeah, I think it's
wrong. And a lot of us are on social media, so we'll put our stories up. But yeah, the AFR is, subscribe.
Yeah, great. It's a no-brainer, I think, if you're an Australian finance, you're an investor, it's a no-brainer. Okay, last question. If you could go back and tell a younger you something about money, finance, investing, what would it be?
It's funny because I had a different answer, but then when you were telling the story about the poor guy at Apple selling his shares, I thought of something that I would absolutely tell myself now, which is don't sell. Because when I was a young boy of 13, my dad put some money in a company called Mnet,
mm-hmm.
which was the equivalent of Foxtel in South Africa.
Okay.
And they were one rand a share, and he put, I think, 30,000 rand. So today's money would be $3,000, but it was probably less in currency terms and inflation-adjusted terms. And Mnet landed up getting acquired by a very old media company called National Press, which is called Naspers, which in 2001 bought a 33% stake in a crappy little Chinese technology company called Tencent for $30 million. And it's a 60,000 bagger. So if I hadn't sold those shares, they probably were $6 million and I probably would not be sitting here today. So,
oh, wow.
So that's my advice. It's buy and hold. Like, I mean, look at even, I don't know, take any Australian stock and go back to the early 90s and you would have made extraordinary gains. So I guess whatever as young as you are, it's you don't need a lot of money, I guess, to again, I'm giving financial advice.
No, it's just common sense.
Every little dollar counts.
It does.
And these are kind of the lessons that Buffett would espouse about compounding. And so, yeah, start early, maybe.
That's great.
Maybe that's how I'd summarize it. Start early and don't sell.
Yep. Great advice, Johnny. Thank you so much for this.
No worries.
Your time and this interview.
Really appreciate enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks again for tuning into the Australian Investors Podcast. For further episodes, head to www.raskfinance.com. To provide feedback, nominate a guest, or hear from me, you can find me on Twitter with the handle @OwenRask. Cheers to our financial futures.